Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, bestselling author Ross Gay discusses his new essay collection, Inciting Joy. In these gorgeously written and timely pieces, Gay considers the joy we incite when we care for each other, especially during life's inevitable hardships. This conversation originally took place November 1st, 2022 at the American Writers Museum and was recorded live.
Tonight's event is presented in conjunction with our newest exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. It promotes a century of writing by some of the greatest poets, essayists, journalists, and novelists on the themes of belonging, violence, justice, and joy. And for tonight's program, in the New York Times bestselling author Ross Gay's new book, he describes joy as a force for connection, solidarity, and survival. He is the author of four books of poetry, Against Which, Bringing the Shovel Down, Beholding, winner of the Penn American Literary Gene Stein Award, and Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, winner of the 2015 National Book Critic Book Circles, National Book Critics Circle Award, and the 2016 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. His first collection of essays, The Book of Delights, was released in 2019, and that was the last time he was here with us, and was a giant New York Times bestseller. So we are extremely honored to have with us again tonight, Ross Gay. So please help me in welcoming Ross Gay.
Thank you. It's good to see you all, and good to be at a table. Too, this is special. So I'm just going to read. I hope it's not too long what I read. If it is, just leave. But don't leave now. Leave when you get sick of it. That's what I mean. At least let me start. I think I'm going to read this essay about time. I'm just going to do it. I was going to ask. Would you rather hear an essay about time or about cover songs? Time, okay. Thank you. I know, see? We'll stay after. We'll do a second one. And so all these essays are called incitements. This one's called Out of Time. Time, the fourth incitement. The other day, I was dropping in a hopscotch, one of our local cafes, and as I was leaving, I noticed I want to say I got off the elevator and was offered French fries the minute I walked in. Someone handed me a bag and said, "You want some fries?" Because they were sharing fries, and I said, "No, I'm good." And then the person said, "They're Five Guys," and I said, "Oh yeah, of course." So we are in the midst of bounty. The other day I was driving in a hopscotch, one of our local cafes, and as I was leaving, I noticed a Be Right Back post-it note at the ready, stuck to a bench by the door. It made me happy, not only for the blue magic marker, all caps, slightly crooked, though quite legible, but because it was indication of, indeed an artifact of, a human, by which I really mean creaturely, by which I really mean lifely, relationship to so-called time, which phrase we can argue about later. The implication of the note is that, the calling of nature or a phone call or a cigarette is more important at this moment than my oat milk cortado with, on some special days, a dot of maple syrup. The calling of a walk around the block or of looking up at a power line in the cold, flummoxed at the three eastern bluebirds swaying on a power line or of, a quick daydream away from the register, away from the whir. It's true, I could sometimes get pissy about such notes, or the mass-produced plastic clock versions of the Be Right Back note, at X time, courteous. Especially if I'm running late for work and didn't have time to make my own cup of coffee. But when I am in my right mind, which, incidentally, maybe means I am not on the mind of the clock, the world of the Be Right Back note, which is also the world of the words, usually, or most often, or if there's not waves, or if it's not morel season, or if the runs at the court are so-so before an establishment's hours, is the world I want to live in. It probably goes without saying that the Be Right Back note in the cafe is extra delicious, ironically delicious, given caffeine's obvious utility to industrialized, mechanized life, i.e., the best part of waking up is my coffee so I can get to and tolerate and knock out of the park this miserable work. If you're lucky, 8 hours of it. If you're not, a lot more. Footnote. There's a lot of footnotes in this book. I have to apologize, but not to you, I guess. Let me read this footnote. One, I'm here reminded of when I worked for a spell for my father at the Burger King he managed in Feasterville, Pennsylvania, when I was about 16 or 17. If I remember correctly, I was paid about $6.25 an hour in 1990 or 91, which is $1 less than the minimum wage today, over 30 years later. To remind you, I was 16, living at home, without children, my bills paid. I scraped up gum, washed oil from the asphalt, got the dust from the vents, cleaned the bathrooms, and when I could, after stacking the cups and Whopper wrappers in the storage shed, made of those boxes a nook in which I napped. We left for work by 5 a.m. in the dark, and in addition to lighting a cigarette the second he walked out the door of our house, the glowing embers of which I watched from the back seat of the car. My station was neither privilege nor punishment. That car's front passenger door didn't open. My father dipped into the same Dunkin' Donuts without turning the engine off, early stage nonstop sports talk blathering on the radio, for a large coffee, light and sweet, every single time. Michael Pollan's book, This Is Your Mind on Plants, suggests caffeine is more instrumental and instrumentalized than I had previously considered, a significant part in the machine of the Industrial Revolution, along with greed, cruelty, slavery, empire, the theft of the commons, genocide, and a few other little things. Small evidence of which is the institution of the coffee break in factories, which helped keep workers on the track, which helped keep workers on track, on pace, on time, on the clock, or helped keep the clock on us. I wonder what came first, this brutal innovation, the non-sun clock, or the Puritan adage about idle hands. Either way, there is a barbed wire tether between time and virtue, by which I mean, probably obviously, the proper usage of time in this regime, i.e. not fucking off, is considered virtuous. And why wouldn't it be? Our bodies, maybe someone's already said this, are cogs in a machine that can't stop, won't stop. And to step out of cogness, which means often simply stepping out of time, or rather out of productive time, e.g. sacks of cotton per day, you come from these people? Probably you do, one way or another. Is in fact an assault on capitalism. And capitalism is an assault on life. That's putting it mildly. So it seems to me we ought to follow this thread a little bit more. When I mentioned to my friend Bernardo that I was going to write about joy, he suggested I do an essay on the hang. Footnote. A synonym for which is visiting. And it's how an old timer who grew up with my mother and showed up at a reading of mine said it as he was telling me afterwards about my mother and her folks. My mom was best friends with his big sister. He delivered milk to my grandparents when they lived out on the farm. They'd call him in to have a cup of coffee. It went on a bit. And as he was noticing and enjoying the memories and stories emerging, it looked to me like lights turning on in a building with many windows. He said to me, "You know, Ross, you forget the stories until you start visiting like this." But when I, he suggests I do an essay on the hang, footnote, comma, I should have read that someplace else, by which he means hanging out with no discernible purpose or goal, with no discernible end in sight. Or maybe it's more accurate to say that the conclusion of the hang will be bodily, having to eat or sleep, or relational, gotta go home to make dinner for my lady, or even earthly. Damn, it's getting dark and I'm on my bike, I better go. But before I do, Lord, these fireflies. Yo, have you ever heard Nina's version of George Harrison's My Sweet Lord? Come on, let's do that first. Put it on the record player. It was Don's. You won't believe this. Let me tell you, I know few people as good at the hang as Bernardo. When dude sits down on our porch, sometimes after we've worked out, sometimes after we've played ball, sometimes after we've gone over some poems, he will cross his legs and topple into the first of several stories. It is a study in associational narrative logics, And the last thing he's thinking about, I have to tell you this, is that you or he maybe has to be somewhere. The last thing he's looking at is his watch. Everyone's got everything to do, but when you drop into the hang, that's all there is to do. Or how my Filipino friend Patrick Rosal says in his tract on the lateness of Filipinos, flavor is a function of time. Footnote. Or how in my favorite chapter in one of my favorite books, Gene Smith's Sink, by the writer Sam Stevenson, the jazz drummer Ronnie Free's life story is recounted, mostly in his own words. In this feat of lyric archival work, Stevenson, scouring the thousands and thousands of hours of audio tapes that the photographer W. Eugene Smith made in his famous jazz loft from 1957 to 65, found a conversation with Smith, Free, the saxophonist Zoot Sims, and the pianist Bill Potts. They all get to talking shit and start teasing Free for moving in and staying a long while. Sims and Potts to Smith about Free say, "He's been with you all this time, man?" Smith says, "Ever since I made the mistake of inviting him in a couple of hours. Potts says, "Then he stayed for a few years, huh?" To which Free responds, "Shit, I ain't got no watch." If I told that to my mother, whose 80th birthday it is today, happy birthday, Mom. If I said, "Man, this dude could stretch out into time through time. This is one clockless motherfucker." I am sorry to confess, I am now a gutter mouth, even in the presence of my dear now octogenarian mother. I guarantee you she would say something along the lines of, maybe verbatim, "Must be nice." Inside your mom too. Yeah. Inside that apparently benign phrase, mind you, she is now retired and the only clock she is on has to do with her grandchildren, her walk at the Y, and whatever TV show she can't miss. There are several. Whoever is now Charles Kuralt is one of them. I'm glad you like that. I love that joke, but yeah. It's generational, I gotta tell you. Whoever is Falcon Crest, another, also generational. One of the 8 shows about solving murder cases, Terror Dome News, the Philadelphia Eagles. It's her own experience of being, until she retired, always on the clock. And the clock always on her. Although it's true my mother grew up on a farm where the clock was the needs of the system, which included dairy cows and chickens and hogs and corn and alfalfa, feeding and milking and calving and weaning and egging and slaughtering and combining, which also included harvesting rhubarb and strawberries and cherries and raspberries and chokecherries and apples, and involved getting in your onions and potatoes and leeks and spinach and lettuce and squash, and then harvesting your onions and potatoes and leeks and lettuce and squash. All of which is to say, although she came up on a more seasonal, a more earthly time, she spent her adult life on the factory or factory adjacent clock. She was always getting her hours in, extra hours now, so in summer she could take a few hours off on Friday. Or Saturday hours for which she was paid a few bucks more, so maybe she could afford a week off to see her folks, who were retired now from the farm and living in town with a beautiful garden, probably more flowers this time around. The last 5 months of my father's life, my mother has now let me know, she was constantly terrified of being fired. And she was constantly terrified she was going to get sick and fired. The company she worked for was, hard to believe, I know, in a period of downsizing, rearranging, cutting the fat, outsourcing, excising, because she was the one with good insurance and they needed the insurance. She knew what we all know, which is that worrying about getting sick and worrying about what you will do if you get sick will make you sick. And so she worked as many hours as she could. She went in early, she came home late, she even worked overtime, not only to prove she was worth their time. She was devoted, a devotee to their clock, but as a way to bank hours for when my father would be convalescing, recovering, which did not happen. His time ran out while my mother gave her time to the factory. And believe me, my dad would have done the same thing, because though that dude enjoyed a glass of wine or a truly doofy movie or an Eagles game or gently and patiently caramelizing an onion for something he was going to feed to people he loved, being brokish as he was, he was always looking for clocks to get on. I hate to admit, but when kids who live where there exist lawns are broke in the summer, I'm like, yo, go mow a lawn. Or if kids where there exists snow are broke in the winter, I'm like, yo, go shovel a walk or something. The adjoining clause is, and get out of my face with that shit. Partly because that's who I come from. Just like my mom, my father worked his main job 60 or so hours a week, on top of which, just like my mother, he had a paper route. When I was talking to my mother about delivering newspapers, she exhaled hard and said, quitting that stupid route was the happiest day of my life. Which perhaps explains the difficult conversation my old man and I once had, though it was but one example in a genre of conversation between us. The summer after my first year of college, when I was living with them for the break and had taken over for the summer my father's paper route. This was in exchange for them covering my car insurance, which he had taken over from me. But first, as my mother always reminds me, it makes me proud of myself when doing so. Although I received a real-life 754-year college scholarship from the Bucks County Courier-Times for my nearly decade of service, aside from my stick-to-itiveness, I was, in my mother's opinion, the single worst paper boy in the history of the occupation. Not because I didn't get the papers mostly there, mostly on time, but because, and this got my folks goat, I treated the route like an ATM and only collected when I needed gummy bears or money for the arcade or comic books or a new skateboard, etc. I was undiligent, disorganized, and trifling. I probably did not collect all the money owed me, but I always had spending money for the movies. I did not want to be the richest paper boy. I wanted enough for Nightmare on Elm Street and Twizzlers. Anyhow, I came home, and though I was working 40 hours as a lifeguard, some other gig came up, another 16 hours at a pool or something, maybe it was 12, which I declined. 40 was enough for me by far. Besides, I was putting in work at the gym, hours, training for football, which was the way I paid for my higher education. Pumping iron, speed workouts, playing catch, readying myself to endure and dish out all those subconcussive blows to the head. When my father caught wind of this money left on the table, those hours unutilized, he kind of lost his mind. Why I have retained the precise scene and setting of the conversation, I do not know, but it is summer. My father is returning from work, dark blue polyester pants, a light blue button-up shirt with a tiny red lobster on the breast pocket, coming into the house as I am on my way out to play basketball. Perhaps it's a threshold conversation. Anyway, as I'm holding the ball on my hip, t-shirt with the sleeves cut off, the super big and a tad droopy shorts we wore at the time, my kicks still unlaced, my father tells me, per the hours, loud, disgusted, I swear I'm not paraphrasing, that I am going to be a beach bum and that your little friends are not going to come hang out with you when you're a beach bum, when you're a bum living on the beach. You know, it was funny because when he said that, like I said, I don't really like the beach that much. And as though to punctuate, because my mother came across a used condom in the trash can in my room and surely bent his ear about it, he slams the gavel on his prophecy with, and don't be fucking in the house. Who could blame them? Not about the condom. That was weird. Exactly. That's what I was like. And then she called my brother, who was working at Burger King also. We all worked at Burger King. And my brother, he was fucking with my mom. He was like, was it used? I mean, about me not taking every possible gig, every hour of remunerable labor, not paying now with my time so that in the future, wait a sec. In the future, what? Oh, I remember. We're operating inside the religion of capitalism, whose gospel is that there is not enough. Footnote. Strange that this coincides with the tenet, an equally magical belief, of endless growth. Capitalism preaches the gospel of scarcity and, as such, demands we see scarcity everywhere. And if scarcity is nowhere to be found, it will be imposed. Among those imposed scarcities of health, of food, of clean water, of adequate shelter, of comfort, of community, of meaning, of a future, is that of time. And to believe otherwise, in enough, say, in abundance, say, in gratitude, say, in the unmitigated, unbounded hang, say, makes you blasphemous, or a heathen, or a criminal, or out of your goddamn mind. I can't tell you how many times I've heard conversations about W.H. Auden's famous line from his poem In Memory of W.B. Yeats, quote, poetry makes nothing happen. I have been to panels titled such, where people have hand-wringing conversations about the political utility of poetry. You know, can poetry be an agent of change? Can poetry interrupt the regime? Can poetry bring the masses into the streets to shut this thing down? Always invoked in these conversations is Neruda, whose poems, even the long ones, coal miners in Chile could recite. Or some Russian poets who filled stadiums because the people needed it. It was under the brutal repression of communism, etc. Seems to me those poets and attendees would have been sent to Siberia or the Gulag, but I guess that's not the point. The point everyone insists on desperately is wrong, WH, poetry makes something happen. At some point, probably I heard someone else say it. There's a footnote that says, that's a link to an article that says it. It occurred to me that all these poets and all these conversations were misreading Auden's line, and that he was really talking about, in as much as a poem is him talking about something, what poetry makes, the sometimes product or effect or wake or artifact of poetry or a poem. Granted, the line feels emphatic, grand, provocative even. Seriously, I can't tell you how many tweed-jacketed refutations to Auden's line I have endured. No one has ever explained to me the elbow patch. But what the line makes made is not nothing, but nothing happening. Or rather, nothing happening. The happening it makes is nothing. In other words, a poem or poetry can stop time, or so-called time at least. First of all, what a good reminder it is that a poem is an action. And as Auden has it, a powerful one too. Secondly, and not for nothing, this is one of the suite of poems Auden wrote in the late 30s and early 40s, a period when one might have wanted so-called time, the clock, the airplanes, the trains, the perfectly diabolical, synchronous goose-step rhythm of time itself, to stop. Unless, of course, you were the regime, or IBM, or Bayer, or the arms manufacturers, or the munitions makers, or the other companies profiting from the slaughter. More sales, more slaughter, more sales, more slaughter, more sales. Footnote. As Arundhati Roy asks, rhetorically, in her book Capitalism, A Ghost Story, quote, do we need weapons to fight wars, or do we need wars to create a market for weapons? After all, the economies of Europe, the United States, and Israel depend hugely on their weapons industry. It's the one thing they haven't outsourced to China. End footnote. Unless you are among the prophets and profiteers of progress, which so often is another word for murder, albeit sometimes murder outsourced, you too might have been praying for a way to stop the march of so-called time. And poems sometimes might do that. Poems are made of lines, which are actually breaths, and so the poem's rhythms, its time, is at the scale and pace and tempo of the body, the tempo of our bodies lit with our dying. And poems are communicated ultimately body to body, voice to ear, heart to heart. Footnote, the heart's perhaps the most reliable clock we have. Even if those hearts are not next to one another in space or time, poetry makes them so. All of which is to say, a poem might bring time back to its bodily, its earthly proportions. Poetry might make nothing happen. Inside of which, anything can happen. Maybe most dangerously, our actual fealties, our actual devotions and obligations, which is to say the most rambunctious, mongrel, inconceivable assemblage of each other we could imagine. You ever been on a dance floor like that? Ever on a basketball court like that? Ever in the long, sweaty, collaborative dream of an orchard like that? Ever in a study group like that? A potluck? Ever a forest? Ever a garden? Ever a conversation? A classroom? Ever an impromptu rendition of Shy's If I Ever Fall in Love? Ever a hula hoop gang? Ever when making applesauce from the apples from your beloved neighbor's tree? Everyone trying to get the steps from the video of New Editions If It Isn't Love? Ever on your roller skates, your skateboard? Ever making love? Ever at a laying out of hands? Ever in a dream? Probably I do not need to tell you, but resting inside that nothing happening, inside those idle hands, maybe dormant, maybe like seeds needing fire to germinate, in this case, the fire of hanging out unregulatedly and off the clock, is meaning. We mostly dream, I'm saying, off the clock. And our dreams, well, it's always good to re-remember Audre Lorde, whose brood we are. Quote, our children cannot dream unless they live. They cannot live unless they are nourished. And who else will feed them the real food without which their dreams will be no different than ours? End quote. I think we all know what the fake food is, but the dream, who knows? That's the point. But I suspect it might have something to do with who used to be your coworker, but who became in a sliver of nothing happening, a crack in the clock, your co-dreamer, with whom you together stuck the be right back note on the door, which was a lie, for you will never be, and were so kind as to leave the door open on your way. Bye-bye. Thank you very much. That wasn't that long. Huh. Okay, so we can do questions if or anything like that. We can have a conversation. Yes.
So I got this from you, of course, but what's something beautiful you've seen today?
Many things. The French fries. Yeah. Beautiful. Another thing, there was someone, I just saw someone like walking down the street before I came here. I just watch interactions a lot. And someone was in their wheelchair going to a door that, you know, didn't have a button on it. And someone was walking by and they had their ears things in. So they were already like sort of partly alienated from the world, but they saw and they went and opened the door, you know? Yeah.
Have you had this joy and delight all your life, or was there some point where you suddenly changed?
No, I mean, I think this is useful to say that one of my my therapist said years ago, kind of in the middle of writing that Delights book, saying something like, oh, you have a kind of a fundamental distrust of people. That seems interesting to me. I mean, I cracked up laughing when he said it, because I was like, oh, that's why I'm writing this book. You know, I'm trying to like work on that. But I don't think it's like I don't think it's at all native to me. I think it's I don't know. I do feel like there's probably a way that a particular kind of pointed psychological trouble in my 20s made me inclined to start looking in directions to figure out how to kind of stay okay or ish or okay-ish. Like when I think of like reading like Pema Chodron and stuff, this teacher, her book, you know, The Wisdom of No Escape, I remember that book, like kind of when I needed to hear that like your thoughts could just be like clouds passing through the sky. And I wonder if that was like one of the things. I'm not positive about that, but I don't think it's just like I don't think it's necessarily my inclination. Just my inclination, you know. It's partly, yeah.
How does your dad feel that you made a living or like, you know, put yourself through college playing sports when he thought it was just going to turn you into a beach bum?
Yeah. I love that. I don't know that he thought that playing sports was going to turn me into a beach bum. I think he thought not working was going to turn me, you know, turning down the job. But I love that, that formulation. But Yeah, you know, my mom says a lot. She says like, oh, he'd be so glad basically that, you know, you're okay. You know? Yeah. Then she says shit like, you know, we weren't sure. Yeah. There's a question.
What was your experience writing this book compared to like the Book of Delights, where it's kind of like a daily, semi-daily journal, like writing this one?
This was, partly what's so interesting about those, was interesting about that project. And I just wrote a second one. I'm sort of curious about like seeing what happens if the project happens every 5 years, say. Part of that, like 30, I gave myself a 30 minute, it's like 30 minutes to draft the essays. And there's a certain kind of thinking that happens when, for me, you know, there's some way that like just getting rid of the possibility of making a really beautiful thing and instead just making like really like an attempt, like an essay is an attempt. That was such a kind of, I don't know, a relief or an opportunity or something for me. These essays, because they didn't have that, I feel like there's just some different kind of way. And not that I thought these are going to be great, because they felt also like, where are we going to go? What are we going to end up? Which is kind of like how that's how I like to write. I'm really interested in being lost in my writing. But they were longer, you know, and I knew I had more time to kind of stretch out. And if I wanted to like repeat myself or to go somewhere and circle back in a big way, I could do that. And then the other thing is that maybe the significant thing to me, I don't know that that's right, but like a very significant thing is that those footnotes, you know, if you look at the book, you'll see some of those footnotes become as long as like, you know, twice as long as most of the essayettes in the Book of Delights. They're like, you know, four page footnotes. And that was like a kind of formal structure I realized to like a formal way to digress, you know, to have these long digressions that you could read later or you could read at the moment. And then I was sort of realizing that something that the Delights try to do is to be close to a reader, but this in a longer form thing, like where the inquiry is a little bit longer, those footnotes feel to me like a way to be like, hang on, I gotta tell you this, you know? And then it could be like, it might just be a little story about working at Burger King for $6. Or it could be a whole kind of history of my, you know, playing football or something, you know, and masculinity and crying or something, you know.
So, yeah. Sorry, you kind of touched on this, but we have someone online, Nikki online is asking, first, this essay is so poetic. Why did you choose the essay format for this instead of poetry?
Mm. If it was in lines, it'd be a book. It'd be too many lines. Yeah, that's all. I mean, that's not exactly it. Why did I write it as a... I don't know. That's a good question. You know, it's like, it's sort of the question of like, why do you choose to write something in poem, in lines or however you call it, like as a poem or an essay? I say this and I don't know if it's true, but I'll say it anyway. And it's something like, I go toward poems when there's a kind of unknowing that is further away. The unknowing is greater, I should say. And so part of the way that I can approach that unknowing, the kind of thinking toward or in the midst of that unknowing, maybe is like a sonic knowing, you know, or like a knowing that has to do precisely with the breath. Like the line is some kind of different bodily thinking that can kind of reach toward or accommodate some other kind of greater mystery. I mean, and maybe the essays are a little bit more, the mystery is a little bit more palpable or something. I'm not positive about that. And, you know, maybe in like 20 years, depending on how things work out, we'll have that conversation again.
But we have another person online, Tina asking, she has a lot of complimentary sentences here, but I'll just get right to the question. Can you talk
Tina.
About how you write an essay? What is your process? Like, example, do you walk away and come back to it, even like physically to kind of break it up some?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, bless you. I like all kinds of different ways, I guess. But yeah, totally. Like I think maybe the most important thing is how much I revise, actually. Like I draft stuff, parts of stuff fairly quickly, and then it takes me a long time to make them interesting to me, you know? Usually at first it's like I get somewhere and it's just really like, you know, kind of like not, it's really not ready in a way. And by ready, I mean, it's not actually as strange as it needs to be. That's actually what I mean. And then, but I think, yeah, the main thing is that I revise, and that revision can happen, you know, a lot quickly, but then it often happens over a length of time. So yeah, like being walking around or just being in different spaces. Also, this book had not just a few, like quite a few moments where I woke up and had an answer to a problem in the essay, you know, and it wouldn't be like a dream told me the answer, but it would be, I woke up and I knew how to do the footnote finally, you know? Oh,
yeah. I was just curious about, does it feel strange to be, to have become this, you know, spokesperson for delight and joy? Or do you feel self-conscious when you're ordering your cortado? Like, I gotta be delightful. No.
I never said fuck you to a cook.
No, but I want to say fuck you to a lot of other people, though, believe me. But they ain't the clerks. No, I mean, but the thing that is that I'm wary of and like refuse is, you know, people are inclined to sort of endow you with a certain kind of wisdom. That's not me. You know, like I'm thinking about shit and I'm thinking about it with other people. Yeah, but so if that ever starts to sniff around, I like, no thanks, you know. But as far as a kind of subject of inquiry, it's not a bad one. You know, it's not a bad one. And partly because it, as far as I'm concerned, it entails everything. Like when you're talking about joy, you're talking about how we die, you know? So it's, and on and on and on. Yeah. Thanks.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, for this time essay, when you started writing it, did you start like with the intention of writing about time, or is the theme of time something that emerged like after writing through revision?
No, I knew there was something, but it was the note. It was that little post-it note that was the occasion. I'm so glad you said that, because I kind of forgot this. It was a post-it note and I was like, oh, that's awesome. You know? And then I was like, why do I like that so much? Why is that interesting to me? And partly it was interesting to me because I'm interested in like the ways that people, you know, fuck around inside and out of time. But yeah, that was it. Though I didn't know where I was going to go, because at some point, I think I was probably reading the beginning of it to my buddy Bernardo, and he was like, "Oh, you got to talk about the hang," you know. Or at some point, he said something like that. So there was veering that happened, but that was one of the essays that I knew was an essay about time. Yeah.
Hi. Hey. I'm so happy to be here. I just want to say, it kind of cracked me up, the numbers 88. That's the year I graduated. I had a paper route. I collected, but I was late every day for
you
the
were?
Paper. And
lovely.
I just want to say, Bernardo is the guy that I date in Chicago for 12 years. He looks like Snoop Dogg and Tupac. He's very handsome, but he's a beach bum. But and the condom story, my sister. Her bedroom, my mom and dad went on vacation. I got in so much trouble. It wasn't my condom. It was my girlfriend and her little boyfriend. It was very humiliating. I had to go to confession. I just want to say, you know, I'm very happy to be here. And you know, what got me to come was just the word joy. And I'm just so happy to be here. But also to say, David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest.
Had long footnotes, right?
Oh, a lot, yeah.
Yeah, see, I never read that book. I feel like I may have picked it up and been like, ooh, too long, you know? But the footnotes, my footnote, it's Juno Diaz. It's The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. When I read that book, and I was like, holy shit, this is like the author stepping out from behind the kind of veil of the book to say, here's a few more things you need to know. I could have read those all day long, you know? God, thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for your reading. My question is, what is a lesson that you find that you keep having to learn over and over again, either as a writer or in life in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I feel like this applies maybe to both things, you know, the question of joy, I think, is among many things, is like the understanding that you belong to something greater than yourself, or whatever the word for greater is. And I feel like part of my, you know, development as a person or something is being sort of terrified of that, you know, being very sort of defended in a certain kind of way of being all the things that I sort of aspire to be, like movable and porous, all the things that I am, in fact, but for various reasons have, you know, sort of maybe like the shorthand is like ego, that, you know, and I feel like there's tests to that all the time. And that feels really important too to writing, you know. Like I feel like if you're trying to actually sort of have not to like any prescriptive nothing, but like what I for myself consider a kind of interesting inquiry, an inquiry that might in fact change your life, which is what I'm trying to do when I'm writing these things. It seems to me you have to be perpetually willing to acknowledge and practice being unknowing. Bewilderment has to be your kind of method, you know? And part of like bewilderment, great essay by Fanny Howe, by the way, called Bewilderment, God. I kind of want to look at the etymology for it. But part of being bewildered is to just know that it is beyond you. You know, and in a way, I wonder if it's almost like you're at the mercy of it, you know, it being something that you can't exactly understand or explain, I wonder. But yeah, so maybe, I don't know, like something like being patient and loving with my bewilderment, something like that.
So how can, as a teacher of high school students, how can we teach kids to find joy in writing, and how can we teach books that are more joyful than the suffering that I inflict on the children constantly? Because I'm telling you, I've been working really hard this year to find books that are not people, well, you know, that are not canonical, and I'm not necessarily not canonical, but that are not the typical suffering that I, for instance, I teach World Lit, right? Yeah. And our lineup is Oedipus, it's Antigone, it's Hamlet, it's a bunch of Russian short stories. Yeah. How much land does a man need? 6 feet for his grave. I can't do it, Ross, I can't, okay? And so this year I've been trying to do some different things, and the kids are responding, but you know, it's difficult. I started asking people that I knew, everybody that I knew, it didn't matter who it was, what book do you turn to for hope? I started fights.
Yeah.
So how do we make the writing process joyful?
I mean, it sounds like it would be, maybe there is such a thing, like I'm immediately thinking, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was like a, whatever you call it, like a collective or consortium of teachers, high school teachers, who are trying to figure out how to like read about joy, like complicated notions of joy, like how cool. So, you know, other teachers in the room, there's like a group to be made. Yeah, totally. Like what a cool thing to like build out a kind of list for that is not simplified and not like, you know, not like a Hallmark thing, but that is like a fully complicated like sort of thing. You know, what I'm going to tell you or wonder about with you is you might be like, well, I can't do that. But I think grading is terrible. You know, I just think it's horrible. And I feel like there's ways that evaluation all around in the, you know, certainly at first, it's just bad. It's just not great for how we think, for our capacity to have fun, you know, and just do strange stuff, you know. So I know the kind of limits of certain situations, but I wonder if there are ways to, because it's me too. You know, I teach college writing. Yeah, I teach college writing. And once I got tenure, I started giving everyone A's, you know. Everyone gets A's, like across the board. And, you know, I don't feel bad. At grading time, I used to always feel like shit because because the real thing was like the rubric is effectively like you're kind of saying what's going to happen, but a rubric is effectively the explanation for how I'm going to cut you down. It's the explanation for what I'm going to detract points from you, you know, and there will be points detracted. Like you are not, you can't be perfect, you know? And, so once I could do that, you know, then the, and you know, and if there's many things that can happen from that, but I also think in you learn how to do it or you get good at it. Sometimes people in college, like if you say everyone's getting A's, it doesn't matter. You know, some people are going to make the choice to do something else. And maybe that's like go to the cafeteria. Maybe that's smoke weed or thing. Maybe it's like work on their basketball game. Maybe it's work 12 hours at the lifeguard. You know, I don't know. But to me, partly I'm like, at least they're making a choice. Because it seems to me that so often one of the things that education does is to make people incapable of making choices. You know, obedience. I think school is mainly about obedience, you know, and critical thinking is really, it seems to me, and I teach college and I'll say, not only among the students, though, just among the populace, it feels like critical thinking is, you know, we need to work on that. And and all around too. I'm not talking, you know, all around. And if we're just training students to do what we want of them, to be obedient, to follow the rules, to, you know, it just feels horrible to me. It feels horrible. And furthermore, for the students, I think it probably feels, it probably doesn't compel them to try stuff, you know? So that would be like my main thing. If there are ways at all to sort of like withhold the evaluative thing, even though I think probably mostly in high schools, you gotta end up doing that kind of stuff. And the other thing I would say, and this kind of makes me, you know, I think about with my students is that if I'm teaching writing, you know, because so often the thinking process is, and this is across the board. This is like, I remember being in a room with the writer, Michael Pollan, and he was talking to a bunch of, you know, people at a thing at Harvard. We were all like at this thing called the Radcliffe Fellowship. And he was giving a talk to these academics who write books and they teach writing. And he said, you know, he said he tries to start with a question and then he follows the question. As opposed to what academic writing is usually, is you start with a thesis and you prove your thesis. These people's minds were so fucking blown, man. They were like, what? You know, some of them are like, we've been doing this to our poor students all this time. And it's so simple. It's start with a question. Yeah. Like, what if we, and then you think about that, like in terms of like our relationships too. Like instead of me imposing what I know about you on you, what if I'm like, well, what do you, you know, get curious. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Folks, I'm afraid that that's all the questions that we have time for tonight, but Ross is going to be signing books around the front of the museum. If you'd like to get a copy of Inciting Joy, you can do that from Seminary Co-op in the back, and we will line everybody up out around the front. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for
and
coming.
And Ross, thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, tune in to the Fierce Reads Nonfiction Panel, a discussion about nonfiction writing and the wide range of possibilities within the genre with nonfiction authors Alex Grudens, Jessica Vitkus, Ashley Woodfolk, Achyut Dang, and Keeley Hutton. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.